It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we discuss updates from Ukraine, get the latest on developments around nuclear saber-rattling, and we interview John Spencer, author of the mini-manual for the Urban Defender.
This hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure.
Putin's war in Ukraine has destabilized energy markets the world over.
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Tuesday, the 6th of December, day 286. And today, I'm joined by three experts who are all former soldiers. Our associate editor, Dominic Nichols, former British Army colonel who is now director of Doctors Under Fire and an expert of chemical, biological, radiological and nuclear weapons, Hamish de Bretton Gordon. And our guest today is John Spencer, former US Army, who's now an author and chair of urban warfare studies. I started by asking Dom for the latest from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David, and hi, everybody. It's been a day of, or 24 hours of, aerial activity. So I'll come on to yesterday's drone strikes in just a moment. But the news from this morning was that there was another drone strike on an airfield inside Russia in the Kursk region. It borders Ukraine. No further details about that. However, it comes just a day after those two big strikes yesterday. So firstly, on the one in the Kursk region, the local governor has said that as a result of the drone strike in the area of the Kursk airfield, this is a direct quote, an oil storage tank caught fire. There were no casualties. OK, fine. So we'll deal with that as the news comes out. Of course, remember yesterday, the initial news that came from Russian media channels was that there was a fuel truck that had caught fire and killed three people and injured some others. I mean, that turns out that was technically true, but the fuel truck caught fire as part of the explosion that smashed up the Tu-95 Bear long-range bomber next to it. So on to those strikes. Yesterday, we had two strikes deep inside Russia, thought to be now the you know, yet to be confirmed. Ukraine still haven't claimed responsibility. Nobody has claimed responsibility, but it's assessed to be an attack by Ukraine. And we think it was the Tupolev Tu-141 Strij drone, which translates very roughly, and not just my bad translation, but translates as Swift. Now, this is an old Soviet-era reconnaissance drone. I think they also used them for aerial targets for jets to go up against and what have you. I mean, first seen in the 1970s, really basic technology, and it shouldn't have got that far. It shouldn't have got hundreds of kilometres inside Russia, no matter where it came from. I mean, the air defences should have seen it coming, should have done something about it. Just take your minds back to March the 10th of this year. Another Tupolev Tu-141 crashed in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia, having flown through Romanian and Hungarian airspace. Now, at the time, everybody thought that was a Russian drone. We still don't know. It might be Russian. Maybe it was Ukrainian testing whatever they used yesterday. If indeed they did, we don't know. I think probably it was Russian. However, it caused a lot of consternation at the time. It flew over Croatia and, like I say, Romania and Hungary, and although we are told it was picked up by NATO's air defences, it wasn't dealt with. It wasn't shot down. Now, it caused no injuries, but it just shows that you know, air defence networks are not a total. You can get through them. However, it is still a glaring error, I think, by Russia to have these long range strategic bomber sites attacked in this way. And we think two Tu-95 Bears were damaged in the strikes yesterday, and possibly some others. There were at one of the sites. It's the home for the Ilyushin big aircraft that they use for refueling. Just as important. I mean, if you don't get your refueling aircraft in the air, you don't get your bombers in the air, basically. So onto the strikes yesterday. So President Zelensky said that out of 70 missiles launched by Russia, most were shot down. They did result in power cuts across all regions of the country. They are extending into today. The Ukrainian Air Force have given a few more details, and going to get a bit technical here, but you know, it's important to have what information we can. So the Ukrainian Air Force is saying that there were 38 KH-101 or KH-555 missiles. Now, these are air-launched cruise missiles, ranges up to about 3,000 kilometres, slightly different between those two variants, but you know, long-range air-launched cruise missiles. And Ukrainian Air Force is saying that they came from 8 of these Tu-95 bombers, the Bear bombers. Ukrainian Air Force also saying that 22 caliber cruise missiles that we think were either ship launched or submarine launched from the Black Sea fleet with ranges into the hundreds of kilometers. They were also fired. Three KH-22 anti-ship missiles were fired by Tu-22 bombers. These are the long-range supersonic Tupolev bombers. Interesting there, that chimes with what we've seen recently of Russia using munitions in their secondary capacity, i.e. that's an anti-ship missile. It's being fired from the air towards the ground, and as I say many times, it will still go bang when it gets to the X, when it reaches its destination. So still very dangerous, but any munition that's used not in its primary role is never going to be as efficient. So the guidance technology on these things will not be as good if they're going air to ground as opposed to sort of against a ship. It's just the way they're built, and we think they're doing this because simply they are running out of other munitions. They're running out of precision guided munitions. They're running their stocks down. They're having to in effect misuse what they've got left in the locker. And finally, there were a number of Su-35 fighters. These are the small jet fighters, but they fired a number of KH-31 HARM missiles. So these are the high-speed anti-radiation missiles, air-to-ground anti-radiation missiles. These are designed to destroy ground-based air defences. So you've got the Ukrainian air defence network with their radars looking up into the sky. They emit energy to come and bounce off any big metal object in the sky, be it a plane or a missile. And what the Su-35s are there to do is to fire missiles that home in on that radiated energy and destroy those radars. And that's the first thing that you would want to do ahead of any package that you're trying to squeeze through to then head on to their targets. So a bit wonkish, but you know, that seems to be the detail. In total, about 70 missiles, of which most were shot down. Most, of course, some got through. I don't think it killed anybody. We think there were injuries and there was damage to infrastructure, but we don't think there are any deaths. Importantly, though, I think yesterday is quite an important day because it shows fairly small, cheap and cheerful, fairly old anti-air defences, such as the German Gepard system, which is a self-propelled gun, twin 35mm cannons that just blast a huge amount of lead into the sky to shoot down aircraft or helicopters or cruise missiles or anything. It's showing that these weapons are up to, if they're in their numbers, they are capable of defeating, you know, a very expensive air attack by Russia. And so when it comes down to the economics of war, I mean, you just can't keep, Russia will not be able to keep doing these strikes of 70 sort of air-launched cruise missiles and others at a time if most are being shot down. A few weeks ago, of course, when there was the clamour for Ukraine to be given these smaller systems, they were having to use very expensive missiles, with, you know, some missiles costing in the hundreds of thousands of dollars were having to be used against the Shahed 136, the Iranian drones that cost about $20,000. So again, the economics there just do not work. But Ukraine seems to be in a better place now and is using older, more simple simple kit against some of these cruise missiles. Of course, there's still a long way to go. And as ever in the military world, it's cat and mouse. So the opposition will come up with some way to defeat your systems, and you then have to get past that. And then they'll come up with a countermeasure, et cetera, et cetera. So it's by no means over. But I think Ukraine are in a much better place than they were just a few weeks ago. And, you know, I've been very critical of Germany in the past, but fair play to them for sending these Gepards. And I think they sent another six, or agreed to send another six last week. So a quick blast there, no pun intended, on yesterday's air attack. There will be more, unfortunately. But I think the takeaway is that Ukraine managed to strike very, very deep inside Russia and defend itself from an air bombardment, which... For those scholars, it will have to happen in slow time. But I think yesterday will prove to be a very interesting day in terms of the evolution of military warfare. But that's a conversation for another time. One more little piece of news before I stop here. Remember last week we talked about Ukrainian embassies and diplomatic missions around the world being sent hate mail and letter bombs in the US. Well, more bloody packages have arrived, the foreign minister said today, in Romania and Denmark. This is after last week there were a number of packages containing animal eyes sent to Ukrainian diplomatic missions. I mean, it seems it's a fairly low level attack. In the letter bomb in the US, the security guard was injured in the hands and the face when the thing went off, but no life-changing injuries, we are told. So this is a fairly low-level attack, unlikely to be Russian state-sponsored, but it is, you know, as with any of these things, you get some crazies who sort of jump on the bandwagon, and you get the copycat attacks. No one's claiming responsibility for these latest attacks, but it's just one to watch there. And I'll take a little pause.
Well, thank you very much for that, Dom Nichols. Just a reminder to our listeners, Dom Nichols and John Spencer, our guests today, are sharing the same phone. So you'll see John speaking when sometimes it's Dom, but hopefully you'll be able to recognise the difference between their voices. Hamish de Bretton-Gordon, thank you so much for joining us again. You've written a fascinating article for The Telegraph. The title is "The West Has Taken Its Eyes Off the Nuclear Ball." That's for our listeners if you want to go and read it. What did you mean by that? What do you think is happening?
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for having me on again. I think with the whole nuclear rhetoric at the moment, Bob Seeley and I, who wrote it, Bob Seeley, MP for the Isle of Wight, has studied Russia in great detail and actually lived in Ukraine. We're looking back at what has happened in the last 20 years, really since the end of the Cold War, and the proliferation of nuclear weapons has been quite stark. China has increased its holdings of nuclear warheads by three, up to 1,500. Iran now appears to be nuclear capable. Certainly the Israelis are convinced about that. And also North Korea is, I don't think they're nuclear capable yet, but they have ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and probably warheads, but probably haven't yet fitted them together. And I think that's against the backdrop of what we're seeing in Ukraine. Putin is using the nuclear issue, I think, generally to keep NATO out of the direct fight in Ukraine. And that is working. Bob and I have also written a paper, which sadly won't be published until January in the US. But that is very much looking at, because of the way that nuclear weapons are proliferated and the fact that we've taken our eye off the ball, is that making it more likely that Putin will use the nuclear option in Ukraine? And I'll just unpack that a little bit. I mean, but going to the end, I don't think he will. But there is one scenario, which I'm very keen to get your views on, where he might. And if we look at the context, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a global treaty to prevent non-proliferation, hasn't met for many years, but did meet last summer. The START talks, the Strategic Arms Limitation talks between the US and Russia, were supposed to be happening last week, but the Russians cancelled them at very short notice. Last week also, Putin said he was upgrading all his nuclear facilities in Russia. And only today, Lavrov has actually declared that it's the NATO that's saber-rattling. And when we look at the potential for nuclear, I think the strategic piece, the Armageddon piece over Ukraine, just won't happen. I think there are far too many checks and balances. The tactical nuclear weapons, euphemistically called the sort of smaller nuclear weapons, these are still massive, you know, 10,000 tons equivalent of conventional explosive. I agree with a lot of other commentators that these weapons are probably unusable. Interesting to hear British intelligence last week saying that the Russians were taking tactical nuclear warheads off cruise missiles to use them conventionally, which in a way points to the fact that I'm sure the Brits and the American intelligence know exactly what's happening with Putin's tactical nuclear weapons. So, and also I understand that the state of these things, which haven't probably been tested for, you know, 10 or 15 years, you know, it's possible that they don't work anyway. The third scenario, which I think is the one that most concerns me, is the weaponization of nuclear power stations. We've discussed before the fact that Putin is directly attacking infrastructure, particularly the power grid, to break it down. There are still two active nuclear power stations in Ukraine producing power, and there is a concern that they may be targeted. But it's great to hear the air defense is working so well. But Zaporizhzhia itself is a different kettle of fish. When I was the Peshmerga's chemical weapons advisor in the fight with ISIS, some listeners may remember that back in 2017, ISIS blew up a place called Al-Mishrak, a massive sulfur mine and sulfur factory. This put a huge cloud of sulfur dioxide in the air, 400,000 tons across the advancing Iraqi troops who were heading towards Mosul, and delayed them for 2 or 3 weeks. And this brings me back to Zaporizhzhia, the most likely way that Putin could use nuclear material, because if he decided to attack there, the downwind hazard, as we call it, would go straight across, sort of due west, across the top of Kherson and any direct approach into Crimea. And my sort of question and point for discussion is, looking at Crimea, is Crimea Putin's vital ground? And in military parlance, vital ground is ground that is lost would make your mission untenable, and you should use all means and all weapons necessary to hold it. Conversely, is Crimea Ukraine's vital ground? I would think that at the beginning of the war, pre-24th of February this year, maybe it wasn't Ukraine's vital ground. However, now, certainly with what is coming out of Kyiv, is that probably is. And would a move into Ukraine, would that make Putin approach it slightly differently and potentially lead to the use of either nuclear or, I think in my position, more likely Zaporizhzhia. I'll just stop there. I would like to plug our application on Telegram, which teaches civilians how to prepare and survive any nuclear accident, but I'll come back to that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Hamish. Well, we worked out before coming on air that today we have three former soldiers with probably, we think, over 70 years of experience between them in the British and American army. So let's take Hamish's question on Crimea and vital ground. And can I put it to Dom and John Spencer? What would your thinking on this be?
Well, David, thanks for having me and Dom as well. Honored to be a part of the show. I'm a weekly listener. Zaporizhzhia is a wicked problem. It's not my area of expertise, but I agree with the international community. Just set up a demilitarized zone around it. Get it out of the equation. Russians aren't going to do that. That's the most likely scenario. I've liked that the UN inspectors have been there and remain there to keep information flowing on what's actually happening to avoid what I think Hamish is talking about, which is whether the Russians know they do it or not, some type of global incident because of the fact that they're using it as the base of operations.
Thanks, John. Dom Nichols, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, I think that is at the moment, I think that's absolutely correct, because Putin is pushing this strategy of attacking the energy. I don't think it's working at all. I think all the evidence there is that all it's doing is hardening Ukrainian resolve. And so I just wonder if and when Putin realizes that the idea of some kind of strike on Zaporizhia or any other nuclear power plants would not be in line with the energy strategy, and would be a massive escalation in terms of the radiological fallout from it, literal and figurative fallout. And so I just wonder if actually, whilst I accept that it is vital ground today, I wonder for how much longer that is. I think the longer term vital ground for Ukraine is that support, that political support from externals. I don't want to just say the West, because there's many other countries outside of the West who support Ukraine, but it's such easy shorthand and it takes me longer to explain this. I might just stick with the West a bit, to be honest, from now on. So I just wonder if the efforts we see there, these conversations that we know Putin has with Chancellor Scholz and President Macron and others, I just wonder if he's going to then start moving into that front and sees that as the vital ground. But hey, that's another conversation for another day. But for right now, I think, yeah, for the foreseeable future, I agree that I think these nuclear power plants are the areas to watch, and it needs urgent world attention. Calling the UN.
Thank you very much, Dom. Hamish, do you want to add to that, or shall we move to John Spencer?
Well, just very quickly, I absolutely agree with John. The way ahead is a demilitarized zone, a DMZ, around Zaporizhia and the other nuclear power stations, probably run by the IEA, which is the UN's body on this, maybe needed to be supported elsewhere. But, you know, if the Russians were serious about not wanting to create a massive radiological problem, then hopefully they would go to that. I'm still not clear in my own mind about the Crimea itself, and perhaps you know, that is an area that we need to look at and consider in future, whether if Ukraine did take that over in the next few weeks or months, that might seriously change the direction of this conflict.
Well, thank you very much, Hamish. Do stay for the rest of the talk. We're talking now to John Spencer, our guest today. I think actually this Hamish, what you've been saying leads into what we're going to be talking a bit with John about kind of perfectly. The reason Crimea is becoming vital ground for Ukraine is due to a huge part to the success of the Ukrainian armed forces. John Spencer, before we get into the details of this, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience, your background?
Sure. Thanks, David. So I'm John Spencer. I'm the chair of urban warfare studies at the Madison Policy Forum, host of the Urban Warfare Project podcast. I spent 25 years in the U.S. Army as an infantry soldier and officer. And then about a decade ago, I started focusing solely on urban warfare. Recently wrote a book called Understanding Urban Warfare, but I've been focused on researching, writing, training militaries, just studying solely combat in urban areas for a long time now, and have been very interested in taking, I'm sure we'll talk about it, a very direct role in the war in Ukraine, because it has been, and the lessons that should be there is that all roads lead to urban. In the Ukraine war, we know that this war started with the most important strategic objective was the Kyiv, the seat of political power. The Russians failed at that, and there's lots of reasons why they did, but the urban terrain is unavoidable, and that's what I study, that's what I teach, that's what I write about.
So let's talk a little bit about the Battle of Kyiv. You went to Ukraine in the summer to study it. What did you learn? I mean, you just mentioned that, as we know, that the Russians failed in their objective to capture it. Why did they fail?
Well, that's a long list, really, of reasons, both in terrain. Every city is different. I went there to study, I think it is the most important battle of the modern era, a single decisive battle, as in it achieved Ukraine's strategic objectives of, at the time, surviving the Russian invasion. And it took away Russia's strategic objective, which was to basically do a regime change, put in their own proxy. I walked the ground in places like Bucha, Irpin, Mashoun, Brovary, to get an understanding of just how did the Ukrainians do it with really just a single mechanized brigade and a couple artillery units defend against the second most powerful military on paper. We've learned that that's not true anymore. Well, they did it with a mix of civilian support. They did it with a mix of understanding the terrain better, from even raising the water levels of the rivers, blocking all the roads, blowing all the bridges, arming 20,000 civilians on a single day with an AK-47 and two magazines, creating basically a castle, enclosing the gates of the castle of Kyiv, which actually is very applicable to this ancient city that grew on the river. They closed the gates. They funneled the Russians, who had their own problems of being able to do joint warfare, but closed the gates, created death traps, took away the airfield that the Russians tried to use. And the Russians had multiple courses of actions on how they would achieve taking down Kyiv, but every one of them failed in a lot of part due to some genius actions by Ukraine and by the sheer will to fight of the Ukrainian soldiers, and really important, the Ukrainian civilians, which is very unique to this battle, was the mobilization of the civilian population.
Well, there's so much to get into this. We'd like to talk a little bit about the mobilization of civilians later, but just still talking relatively broadly, I mean, did anything surprise you about what you learned about the Battle of Kyiv? Was there anything that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot. I mean, I learned so much, and I met so many amazing people that came out on day one to resist. I found the use of the infrastructure. So in my world, I often had to explain to people what is urban, although most people think they know that it's just a bunch of buildings. But by definition, urban means that there's a lot of buildings on top of natural terrain. There's a population, and then there's the infrastructure to support that population. That's the definition for us of urban. Well, in the Battle of Kyiv, uniquely, not the first one in history, but uniquely, it wasn't the actual fighting of buildings that came into play. It was how the Ukrainians used the population and the infrastructure to support their objective of defending terrain to buy time. That was the key. If you can stop the shock and awe, the attacker wants to use speed, and they should. If you could slow them down just a little bit, buy time for other resources to become. And this is what we saw in the Battle of Kyiv, is that they ground the Russians to a halt, but that wasn't all that had to be done. Other forces had to be brought in. You had to trick the Russians, who thought that it would be a short mission. I learned so much in all the different areas that I couldn't have gotten had I not walked the ground. And that's a real big part of my research. I went to Nagorno-Karabakh last year. I spent a lot of time, because terrain matters. Despite what we talk about a lot in the science of warfare and all the technologies and the weapons, it often comes down to terrain. And terrain really matters in warfare. And really, the Battle of Kyiv is such a great example in so many ways. Even the battle, the skirmish, or the smaller battle of Mashun, where the Russians had found a way to get past all the Kyiv units and defenders, and if they would have gotten through that unit in this village of Mashun on the outskirts of Kyiv, they might have been able to penetrate all the way into Kyiv. But this single company force with some civilian defenders held off, using the terrain, again, using the fact that militaries really can't cross rivers very well, and it's a sometimes unpracticed drill to cross obstacles, whether it's a water obstacle or you park a bus in the middle of the road, it's going to be a big problem for militaries. And we saw all of this. So there is a long list of what I learned, but I was really surprised about the rivers, how the Ukrainians flooded some areas, but they also just raised the river, and not just to Irpin, but two other rivers, to create even bigger obstacles for the Russians to, again, buy time to target them, to break them apart. All these principles of urban warfare that have spanned history, but I couldn't find any other battle that I know of where the Ukrainians did it so quickly, of using their city as a weapon.
This is absolutely fascinating, John. Thank you so much. Just projecting forward, I'm curious to ask, obviously we're talking just now about the Battle of Kyiv, that opened the defence of the city, the successful defence of the city opened the invasion, really. Looking forward over the last few months and to today, how do you see both sides evolving their tactics? Do we think that the Russians have learnt much since their failed assault on the capital? And how have the Ukrainians changed their approach or developed or changed their own tactics?
Yeah, that's a big one, and this is why I come to your space daily and weekly, is to learn, because this war has so many lessons for me, and not just because I'm the urban guy, but what battle have we been talking about, whether it's Bakhmut, Kherson, Lyman, the battles to come over Kramatorsk or Donetsk or Lenet, they're urban areas. Urban areas have this problem of popping up on where you want to go. The road that you want to take, whether it's the major highway or not, is going to go through urbans. Yes, the Russians did learn from their mistakes. And once they changed their overall objective, they were able to focus in on a smaller objective and create a little bit of a gain. That's what we saw when they focused on the Donbass. They started to actually use their own doctrine and using mass and artillery fire. But the Ukrainians also learned, and you showed the world that they can use their weapons more effectively. And in another battle, which will go down, and I write case studies at the Modern War Institute, where I take a battle and I write a case study to try to summarize it. And everybody kept asking me in the Battle of Kherson is, when is it going to get to the house-to-house fighting? And how destructive is that going to be on the city? And like, look, every city is different. The Ukrainians learned and used their weapon systems to create the effect that they wanted, which is make the terrain untenable for the Russian forces who were occupying the city, and they had no choice but to withdraw or die. So they didn't need to go house to house, and that's kind of the problem with some mental frameworks on urban warfare. But the different battles, like the Battle of Mariupol, was night and day to the Battle of Kherson because of the different context and different variables of the terrain, the actual objective for the city. All these variables, I think, will come to play as we see what I think will be the Ukrainians continuing to advance in the offense, but taking each bit of terrain and going through all the mission variables and all the variables that we talk about in the military to do it in a better way. And to not play to your enemy's strengths. And I think that's what we've seen as well. The Russians, when they did learn from their mistakes of trying to do this massive countrywide seven avenues of approach spread too thin, that, okay, we can't do that, so let's do massing. Well, the Ukrainians didn't give them that. The Ukrainians are not going to mass and clash in the open terrain. They're picking them apart behind their lines, attacking the logistical lines, making it so it's untenable for the Russians to stay where they're at. Or in the case of Bakhmut, which is might not make the definition of urban at this point, based on civilian population and infrastructure left, but if the enemy wants to continue to smash against your defense, don't interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake and keep letting the Russians die over Bakhmut, which has no real operational significance, but tactically, if that's where the Russians want to die, then the Ukrainians are giving them that.
Thanks, John. Can I just take you back? I realize in this podcast now, I'm the only one without any military experience compared to Hamish, Dom, and yourself. So I'm just going to ask a question for those of us who are not involved in the military. You said that the Ukrainians are going to be considering all of the variables, all the different sort of variables you consider in the military when you're planning an assault to take back land, take back cities. Could you walk the listeners through what those variables might be? What will they be looking at? What will they be balancing when they think of the coming advance?
Sure. I didn't know I would get tested, although knowing that Dom's here in some of the past episodes, I thought I might be ready. And I did teach strategy and tactics at West Point while I was there. So what I was talking about is usually what we refer to as the mission variables, right? The mission, like what is the actual objective of this operation? And the Ukrainians are doing just these amazing planning process. And we've seen videos of their rehearsals and their whiteboards or their terrain models. So the mission, the enemy situation, the terrain, and when you get to urban warfare, that has a lot of variables in just a terrain variable. The troops available, what formations do you have available? Do you have armor? Do you have a mix of everything from Humvees to MRAPs to Bushmasters? How much infantry do you have? The time available, because time is always a factor based on, and we've seen this in the operational level and at the tactical level, time versus terrain and the Ukrainians' ability to maneuver forces, whether it's reserves or just cover large amounts of terrain faster than the Russians, was a big part, I think, of the last, the Kharkiv offensive, was their mobility and ability. But these things we call mission variables, so that we call it METTC. And of course, you have civilian considerations in there. Those are the kinds of things that every military before an operation goes through those variables and the impacts it will have on the mission. Each one of the variables will have an impact on you and have an impact on your enemy, and if it's urban terrain, have an impact on the civilian population. And there's all the planning, and this is the deliberate process which we are seeing the Ukrainians just get better and better at. I'm so impressed what I see, not just in their morale and the way they carry themselves and their equipment and all of that, but the fact that they're going through this planning process and these mission variables, like we saw. I know that was a major consideration in the Battle of Kherson, was you analyzing the enemy, and each one of these variables, you know, opens up the pages of sub-variables, analyzing the enemy's strengths to determine what attacks and what fires, matrix, and things like that you're going to do in the operation. Hopefully that covers it without, you know, teaching a class.
No, that was brilliant. Thank you, John. And just a couple more questions from me before we'll bring in Hamish and Dom, who I'm sure have many questions as well. We've got a question from a listener just asking to hear a little bit more about Valery Zeluzhny. This is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine. And you've spoken a lot about what the Ukrainians are doing. Can you talk to us a little bit about their commander-in-chief?
Well, I know he's a new guy on the block. I mean, there's kind of a revolving door of Russian generals, which is not a good sign. Zeluzhny. Oh, I thought you were talking about the Russian general. Okay, sorry. Amazing. Actually, you know, not that much in the public eye, which is interesting. But clearly, one of the heroes that will go down in his ability to have that, all these principles of war. And I know we talked about these on the space before. The elements of operational art, the fact that you see him on the battlefield, but he gets a lot of credit. His background is very unique as well, but to be able to lead a military through these phases of a war like this and to keep that unity of command, to manage the inflow of weapons and supply, and to do this is, I'm amazed. As much as I am amazed by President Zelensky, is that the relationship too between, which I did a lot of talking about, you know, there's always a relationship between the generals and the political leaders, and there's all these war theories about, you know, the general wants the politician to stay out of the way and just let me execute this war. You can see there's a relationship between Zeluzhny and Zelensky, that it is a actual back and forth relationship with input for the political objectives, with the best military advice. I am pro Ukrainian to a fault because they are the good guys, but I'm thoroughly impressed as a student of the history of war and the great captains, as we call them, the generals that achieved their nation's political goals. He has been at the center of this and deserves a lot of credit.
Thank you so much, John. Just one more question from me. Can we talk a little bit about your handbook, your book, Understanding Urban Warfare? Because it's sort of, I think, as we can say, it sort of went viral over the past, over the course of this invasion and has been used, as we understand, in the defense of Ukraine. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how did that happen?
Sure. So what you're talking about is my mini manual for the urban defender. So the book Understanding Urban Warfare is a book I published recently.
Forgive me, yes.
No problem. You can buy the one on Amazon if you'd like. But the mini manual for the urban defender is just a very humbling project I've been involved with on February 24th, when the Russians invaded, and I saw calls going out to the Ukrainian civilians, literally over the radio, which is saying, resist, make Molotov cocktails and resist. So I started tweeting, here are the things that I would do based on a little bit of research and a little bit of experience in urban warfare. These are the things that, that civilians could do to help resist, setting up roadblocks, ensuring that they stay protected and utilize the urban terrain to their advantage. Well, those tweets became a manual, and I called it the mini manual for the urban defender. And I just released version 5, which actually I used a lot of the stuff I've learned when I went to Ukraine and studied what they had done that had worked to then teach me about, like, the use of the infrastructure to add to the manual. Well, the manuals, now it's 100 pages long, includes everything from how to purify water to how to set up different types of obstacles, how to park buses in the road and use the terrain to achieve your objectives. It's also been translated now. Of course, it was translated in Ukrainian. By March, the Ukrainian government had put it out on their website for resistors. And then one of the publishers in Ukraine printed up to 100,000 copies, and it was distributed all across Ukraine. So very humbling. But then it was also translated, because it is this manual for civilians to rapidly understand with simple diagrams, simple instructions, what they can do to help you defend their cities, help their militaries. It is a very kind of for a civilian, but I also used to be a ranger instructor, so I put some stuff in there about how to do an ambush correctly, how to carry your weapon correctly. It's also now been translated into about 14, the number keeps increasing, different languages, because there is this ideal of total resistance or total defense, where your civilian population will assist the military in defending their terrain against really evil. So there's been a lot of people interested in it across the world, but it started very specifically to help Ukrainians defend their cities. And I was humbled to see, I just started receiving pictures from around Ukraine where people were using it to, you know, train territorial defenses or even in the army. And it has almost gained its own momentum. But I just released a new version 5, which you can get, you can download in PDF at my website, johnspenceronline.com.
Just out of interest, just before, sorry, Hamish, I know you must have questions, but I'm really curious. So you say there's 5 versions now. What are the new things you've added to it then?
Sure, yeah. I did get a lot of requests what to add, and there's some restrictions, but some of the recent things I've added were like how to use small arms, machine guns, and other direct fire weapons against slow-moving drones or helicopters, which is old, like the Gepard. If you just put a lot of lead in front of the thing and let it run into it, it'll actually bring things down. I added some new stuff about weapons. I added actually law of war, because I think that's really important. And what Ukraine has done from the beginning is kept not only their just cause, but also the just execution of the way they're fighting, to keep their alliances and keep their you know, their hope alive. So I put stuff in there about the law of war. I added more medical, you know, because a tourniquet can save lives on the battlefield, but I added more stuff about medical in there. And I really went back as I was, you know, first version 1, 2, and 3 were very frantically, you know, pushing them out as the need was requiring. You know, I even learned from the Ukrainians about different types of obstacles that I put more detail so that, you know, other Ukrainians in other cities could do rapidly. Or I refined a lot of the information based on what I've learned from the Ukrainians themselves on my tours. And I had more time. So it's really a rewrite. Version 5 is really a rewrite from the earlier version, which was the book that, you know, had a part in Ukraine's defense.
Thank you so much for all of that, John. Thank you for answering all the questions there. Hamish and Dom, I'm sure you've got questions for John. I will let any of you come in when you like.
John, fascinating, absolutely fascinating stuff. Thank you so much. I mean, we are very lucky that we have a huge number of people inside Ukraine listening to this right now, and they will be downloading the podcast later, many of whom may not have been able to get access to the mini manual. What simple practical things could you say to, did you think the most important are to give them right now? And it might be, you know, weapons or medical or tank traps or what have you, but a couple of things they can do this afternoon right now, what would you suggest?
So, I mean, if you put a knife to my back. I mean, number one is understanding how to stay protected from aerial munitions to direct fire. The urban terrain is called the great equalizer for a reason, is that if you're a defender, it's ripe with military already developed terrain, especially the underground. The underground has always been the refuge for anybody. So if there isn't an underground already, you know, in the open terrain or in the wooded terrain, you have to dig trenches. But in the urban terrain, you can connect buildings underground. You can use the sewer networks to plan to move and strike and use guerrilla tactics. Know which buildings you're going to use for whatever defensive purposes, because all buildings are not made the same. You know, a heavy clad steel reinforced concrete building is going to be a really important building to any defender. Or if you just want to stay protected, there's you can slow the military down. Even if it's not a city that the military is attacking, one of the first things I put out, which the Ukrainians started to do, was just block all the roads, block every road, block every alley, every street. It'll slow down and buy time, which can be really life or death in an urban warfare scenario.
Thank you. And so we've been discussing Ukraine, and I just wonder if there's anything specific or unique to the construct of urban environments in Ukraine, anything from the sort of the Soviet history, that the way they built their towns, the way they lay out their roads. So in the context of sort of recent thinking of fighting in Mosul and Fallujah and other urban environments that we've seen, are there any particular characteristics about Ukraine that really we haven't seen very far around the rest of the world?
So that's an interesting question, is because even Ukraine, there's great variable, you know, great differences. But the Soviet bloc apartment building complexes are very strongly built, and often there is also often a warehouse district, as we've seen in places like Severodonetsk or in Mariupol. These factory areas usually are very defendable, very important military objectives, because they give you line of sight, they give you lots of places to hide. There's lots of things there. And this is really what the advantage to any Ukrainian in any city across Ukraine is, that they understand the cities, their cities, both how to get in, how to move around, what are the best buildings to attack from, how to shoot and move, than any other Russian ever will, because it's their city. But there's some uniqueness to the constructions of the buildings. And this is, again, if you're in any city, any urban areas, understanding which buildings are going to be best for whatever mission you have, whether it's to defend or whether you're attacking, the different routes. And this is what we saw during this war, is that the Ukrainians understood not only their cities, but how to get into their cities and the major choke points and the bridges that people will need to, all these things that... I always say there's two challenges in urban warfare. One, there's a challenge of understanding the urban environment. Ukrainians will always have the advantage there. And then second one is understanding how to use the urban terrain to fight, whether it's to attack or to defend. That's something that I think my manual can give a little helpful hints that have worked across history. So that's, I don't rely on my own experiences from the, you know, from Stalingrad to the Battle of Berlin to the Battle of Seoul, Hue. These iconic urban battles, there's things that just keep repeating themselves. The use of barriers, the use of snipers, the use of ambushes, whether it's the Battle of Grozny, where small forces have defeated or at least definitely messed up the plan of a greater by number. The Ukrainian military is, of course, greater than the Russian military, but sometimes there is a numerical disadvantage, and the urban terrain equalizes that.
It's Hamish, perhaps I could come in here quickly. And John, you and I could probably speak all day. And you talk about drones and small arms fire. When I was with the Peshmerga, they fired thousands of small arms at ISIS drones with various degrees of success. But what I also saw in my time in Syria is, you know, when towns and cities are razed to the ground, it gets incredibly difficult for the attacker. And in Syria, the Syrians were very frequently using incendiary weapons, mainly white phosphorus, to set fire to towns and villages to sort of smoke people out. But most sort of clear and devastating in my mind was actually Aleppo back in back in December 2016, where after the Syrians had fought conventionally for 4 years and the last year of that with the Russians and getting nowhere, they then used chlorine barrel bombs for 15 days, which with everybody hiding underground, smoked them out and was decisive, as it was the next year in Ghouta, a suburb of Damascus, and the year after in Douma, that it was actually chlorine that brought an end to those sieges. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that the Russians would use that, but we did see at the beginning of the war when they were on the offensive, the use of things like white phosphorus as incendiary weapons. Is this something that you've seen? And, you know, is this... It struck me, particularly in Syria, it was pretty viable, but these are horrific and illegal weapons. But if you have no morals or scruples, the lecture I gave last week in Cambridge, you would use these sort of weapons all the time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And what we've seen with the Russians is that they really don't... They use war crimes as a method of warfare. Some of the things that I thought about as you were asking me that question was that I actually added to this version of my manual why defend. Because across history, if step one of attacking any urban area is to isolate it, you can do that with fires or you can just completely encircle it like they did at the Battle of Mosul with 100,000 security forces to encircle 5,000 ISIS inside of it. So step one of if you're defending is don't let them isolate you. The other aspect is like you said, the paradox of being in the urban terrain is that the more you bomb it, the more defendable it is. Because a rubbleized building is a lot more defendable than a building that hasn't been struck. That was learned in Stalingrad when the Luftwaffe destroyed 80% of the city, which meant that they couldn't bring the tanks in later and made it a very close fight to happen. But, some people believe that the age of the siege warfare is back. But again, you have to understand those mission variables. Like in the Battle of Mariupol, where 3,000 brave Ukrainians were encircled and sieged, but they held down 20,000 Russians for over 80 days and actually achieved an operational effect of not allowing those Russians to then go attack things in the north and or in Donbass. So they achieved the mission part of the variable, but each one matters. But if you encircle a city, there's so many variables, even from the siege of Sarajevo, which is the longest modern siege, lasted 3 years because it was really never isolated. There were tunnels that could get things in. You could get people in and out. So the battles of Syria, like Aleppo and others, it is unfortunate when you can encircle a city and just bomb it into submission because the variable of time is not there, and you don't care about your war crimes and using starvation and using chemical weapons. Yeah, that's a different level in a situation that is very troubling, which I think the world should be watching in Russia's execution, right? The just war, Geneva Conventions. If none of it is upheld, what does that mean for the future of state-on-state warfare?
Hamish, do you want to add to that at all?
No, I quite agree, and it is such a challenging part of warfare. And I was just very struck by the sort of methods that the Russians were using there. And when they talk about the false flags at the beginning of the war, you sort of realise that the Geneva Conventions and the rules of war are something that don't constrain them. And in fact, they use by not adhering to them, they're using it to further terrify people. And their whole campaign of attacking the civilian infrastructure and civilians, they seem to think that will make civilians capitulate. But actually, of course, morale is a tremendous thing, and it's actually improving the morale and the determination of the civilians to resist in Ukraine. And it didn't really work in Syria anyway, so I don't know. But again, they will do anything to try and stave off defeat at this stage. So I think we've just got to be prepared, which is why I know we're coming to the end. And I just wanted to say a little thing about the training courses on Telegram that we've published in Ukraine so that civilians can survive a nuclear accident or other dreadful weapons. I did tweet it a little bit earlier on with all you guys tagged in, and if you can share, that would be great because it's already got wide coverage. And I sort of want Putin to know that people are prepared. So don't bother to use these weapons because they won't be effective.
And Hamish, very quickly, what is the name of the app? Just so listeners later on the podcast will know.
Yeah, it's the Thompson Foundation app that has been tagged. It is on Telegram. And basically, it's a 10-minute course in both Ukrainian and English, which tells you how to prepare. And in the event of this happening, an accident or an attack, what to do in order that you can survive. Because as long as you're not in the immediate vicinity, you do the right things, you should survive. And reaction to this type of attack or accident is sort of counterintuitive, why it's worth just spending 10 minutes looking at the video on the app.
Just one quick question, John, before we start to wrap up. We've got a question coming in from Kyiv asking to talk a little bit about the lack of electricity. And obviously, this is a big thing at the moment, thanks to the strikes on infrastructure. What kind of advice would you give to civilians who are experiencing a lack of heating, a lack of energy, a lack of electricity as well?
Yeah, that's a really important one. This ideal also of being able to attack the will of the people clearly won't work. I mean, dealing with the blackouts in individual cities and having a plan for warming of individuals, there's a lot of just pragmatic things that Kyiv is showing the world that can be done about the use of sleeping bags or putting blankets up on doors and creating one warm space. Lots being done there, but I don't have any advice that's not already being, I think, put out, hopefully by like the mayor and other individuals. This is, again, why I've learned so much from the people of Ukraine and especially citizens of Kyiv, but everywhere, about what are the things that do work and that other people can learn from. Because everything from the requirements of modern warfare down to the pragmatic things of how to keep yourself warm, the Ukrainians are showing the world that they're going to keep adapting, they're going to keep innovating, and they're going to keep fighting.
John, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for our listeners to hear?
No, I mean, I really appreciate it. I'm a huge fan of the show. I think that this is not a fight. This is, of course, Ukrainians fighting for their freedom and for their land, but they're fighting for Europe and they're fighting for the free world. If they would not have resisted, the world would have changed and Putin and other dictators like him would have been given a green light to do recolonization, wars of aggression, war crimes. They're doing so much, and I'm so respectful of the resistance of the Ukrainians every day and your space, which talks about it and brings the news to the world.
Well, thank you very much, John, and thank you very much for joining us. Can I just ask all of you now briefly for your final thoughts? What will you be looking at and thinking of, and what would you want our listeners to know about over the next few days? Dom Nichols, why don't you go first?
Sure. Well, I just want to finish, if I may, by talking about what all the lessons that John and Hamish have talked about today that are really applicable for individuals under this bombardment and under the threat of chemical biological warfare. But very luckily and very selfishly, most people listening to this, ourselves included here, are not under these threats and under this risk today. However, we also, I think, need to think about our own societal resilience. We were chatting just before this started. How much money have you got in your pocket right now? I've literally got no cash. I mean, that's not the old Sandhurst pat about, I'm sorry, I haven't got any cash on me. But, you know, I literally don't have any cash on me. I've got my contactless card. And if that goes down, then we're snookered. If you've got no money in the hole in the wall, or, you know, you become doesn't work on the tube and the bus and what have you. So just think about our own societal resilience. And if this is, we're in a long fight now, and we are, as I say, most of us are lucky enough not to be under daily bombardment, but we can still do our bit, which is to keep ourselves informed and to keep the conversation going. We all know about Ukraine fatigue. We've heard the term. You get it in every war, every big effort. I would just ask that we all just look after ourselves, look after our mental health, because you've got to take a break from this stuff every now and again, but keep engaged and keep keep informing other people. That I, the amount of conversations I have when people say, "Oh, well, it's all finished, isn't it?" Or Ukraine can't win, and I just think you've not seen any news for, well, arguably 10 months. So I would just ask us all to think about our own resilience and what we can do from this flank, albeit from afar. And I'm not belittling that at all. We are nice and safe here, but we can still do our bit, keep ourselves informed, and help to inform others.
Thanks, Tom. Hamish de Bretton Gordon.
I'd reiterate what Dom said there. I think as we get into the festive period, the chance to rather worry about ourselves and all the things that vexing people in this country and others in the West, really, if we get this wrong, they're quite frankly irrelevant. You know, the inflation, the price of fuel and food will go down once Ukraine is sorted out. And it's those people who are doing the fight, you know, the boots on the ground, if you like, to keep the tyrant Putin at bay, which is so essential. And we must not forget them, and we must keep supporting them with every nerve and sinew over these very difficult next couple of cold and wet months in Ukraine.
Thank you, Dom. Thank you very much, Hamish. John Spencer, as our guest, would you like the very, very final thoughts?
Sure. I'll just piggyback on that, because I do believe the moral factor in war is 3-1 to the physical. And no matter where they are in Ukraine, whether it's the soldier, the territorial defense, the leadership, keeping that moral factor, keeping the morale high, keeping the hope that the world is behind them and that their suffering is valued and that there is a very clear path to victory and that there's the U.S., the West, the 50-plus nations are in it until they win. Keeping that hope alive and reminding everyone that is the path, that Putin has already lost, Russia will lose, and Ukraine will prevail.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast by The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis, and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 30 days completely free at telegraph.co.uk/audio. You can also listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, do leave a review, as it helps others find the show. To our listeners on YouTube, for reasons beyond our control, there's sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload, so if you do want to hear an episode as soon as possible, it's available on your podcast apps. Please search for Ukraine the Latest on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred app. Check out the Ukraine page on the Telegraph website. As ever, you can get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing podcasts@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. We are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest is produced by Louisa Wells and Giles Gear. And today on Twitter, Claire Hubble.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.